when Los Angeles blazed in riots in 1992, suddenly the rest of America started talking about Black-Korean racial tensions. But of course, the story is always more complex. Nadia Kim looks at how notions of race and racism travel across the Pacific from Seoul to Los Angeles. Nadia Kim is assistant professor of sociology at Loyola Marymount University and the author of Imperial Citizens, Koreans and Race from Seoul to LA. Nadia Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You open your book by talking about how your mother liked to watch classic movies like Gone with the Wind back in South Korea. But she was also seeing American soldiers in South Korea, including black soldiers. How did these two visions add up in her understanding about race and America?
Well, I think the Hollywood movies were really about showcasing what white America was like. You know, I mean, they were usually the protagonists, the characters you identify with, you know, not as much diversity, of course, back then. And so it was really kind of this idealization of that country that's so rich, that's predominantly racially white. They live a life of glamour, you know, the things that we don't have here in South Korea, especially during the Korean War. And so in terms of black American soldiers, I think for my mother and many other Koreans at the time, they were really kind of an enigma in some way. You know, they were not the majority. And people, I think, like my mother, were taken aback by their appearance because Koreans had not interacted that much at all with black Americans or had much exposure in the mass media with them. So I think on the one hand, you have this kind of intimate engagement of white America and all its splendor. And then you had these soldiers that, you know, were kind of jarring in terms of their physical appearance, unfamiliar, and they seem kind of like the other that they didn't really know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but how did the attitude towards the American soldier change? Because there was this image first of the American soldier giving out chocolates. But then now you might have, you have the stories about a South Korean woman who is raped and murdered by an American private who is a white American. How has that changed attitudes?
Well, attitudes, I think, became more complex around the 1980s. Up until the 1980s, the South Korean government had really kind of indoctrinated the population with, you know, this pro-American sentiment. You know, they're our ally, they're our brother. They came and saved us after Japanese colonization, and they intervened with our war against North Korea. So I think there was this kind of very positive sentiment generally. And again, the reference point, as you noted, was white American. But I think in the 80s, what ended up happening was something called the Gwangju Massacre, in which student dissidents who were fighting for democracy basically protested in the streets of Gwangju, and the Korean government brutally, you know, came down on these dissidents, leading to what some scholars say are up to 2,000 murders. And essentially, the United States government was implicated because they were the head of the entire U.S. South Korean military forces. So at that point, the anti-American movement began, especially among the students, and then spread into the middle classes and the general populace of South Korea throughout the decade. And I think it was at that point that attitudes really changed. And it links up to the other kinds of military atrocities you talk about, such as the murder of the woman who worked as a prostitute in the military camp towns. And, you know, at that point, I think there was a lot of sentiment about American soldiers being maybe, you know, overall the United States was humanitarian and assisted us, but the soldiers themselves are violent, uneducated, anti-women, anti-Korean women, arrogant, all those things. And so I think, you know, you had this kind of duality, both this love and hate for the United States that got personified through the soldiers.
And when the Koreans started coming to the United States, can you give an example about how this sort of pre-immigration racial understanding of America changed once Koreans actually came to America?
Yeah. So one of the first things I can think of, it goes back to my original point, which is, you know, there's definitely this idealization and envy of white America, you know, the superpower of the world, the richest country with the strongest military and obviously Hollywood and other pop cultural images, as well as American products all over the globe. I mean, that definitely shored up that kind of view. And then, you know, they come to the United States starting, you know, in 1970, especially. That was the beginning of the mass waves that came. And they realized that, you know, not all of white America is rich. They would see homeless people who are white American digging through garbage, you know, roaming the streets. They would see, they experience discrimination. I think that's one thing, you know, from white America, which did not necessarily fit, you know, their pre-migration ideals, that these people, you know, could take their sense of superiority to an extreme. And so I think, you know, they would come to the United States and say, oh my gosh, you know, there's so many different things from what we had perceived before. Another example could just be the actual infrastructure of the United States, the physical environment. You know, the streets weren't all beautiful and clean and the buildings weren't made with gold, you know, so there's definitely kind of that disconnect that they engage once they get here.
What about the fact that once you get here as Koreans, you're suddenly Asian and you're in the same bucket as your own former colonizer like Japan?
Yes, yes. That's definitely something that was interesting to them. So there was one story that an immigrant who's been in the United States at the time of the book writing, 10 years or a little over 10 years, and he said, you know, he couldn't believe it that he would turn on these television commercials and, you know, they would have a diversity of characters because that's, you know, obviously what they like to show usually. And he said, you know, there'd be like this white American or a black American, and there'd be an Eskimo, and then there'd just be this Asian person. It was just this generic Asian person. And he's like, and no one would have any idea if he was Korean or Japanese or Chinese, you know, Vietnamese, whatever. And he said, I realized that that's just the way they do things in the United States. That we all kind of become lumped into this one Asian category. And of course, that's also punctuated by the fact that when people come up to them, you know, they say, are you Chinese? Are you Japanese? Which are the more commonly known ethnicities? Or they won't even know where Korea is on the map. And so that definitely is jarring for them, you know, as a racializing experience.
But how does Korea's own history, its turbulent relationship with Japanese colonialism, fit into how it understands race and how it fits in the hierarchy there?
You mean Koreans in Korea?
Yes. Which baggage, of course, you're bringing to America with you.
Yes, yes. Well, I think there's a generational difference, of course. And I think the first generation, the people who come as adult immigrants, many of whom are middle-aged, they definitely come with this sense of love and hate with regard to Japan as well. And of course, the hatred comes from, you know, historical colonization. It comes from Japan's ongoing battles with Korea over which land is whose, erasing the whole issue of comfort women, the use of sexual slaves, Korean women, by the Japanese Imperial Army. All of those things, right, really feed the hate side. But there's also kind of that love side that is common in cases of colonization, whereby, you know, they idolize Japanese products, you know, they really envy Japanese stature in the world and really try to approximate that status. So I think many of them who come to the United States come with those views. And I think in some sense, it's really offensive to them that they're lumped in with the Japanese, especially given Korean nationalistic pride that's very strong in South Korea because of what they've experienced vis-a-vis Japan and the U.S., but also strong in the United States because of the fact that they become, you know, these amorphous Asians, but they also become minorities. So they definitely still feel that strong nationalism.
But Koreans, among other Asians, are often regarded as one of the more insular Asian communities, that they're harder to reach than, say, the Chinese community. Of course, there's numbers involved, but is there a reason why it's felt Korean communities are so tightly knit?
I think part of that has to do with the fact that Koreans don't have as extensive and as long a history in the United States as Japanese and Chinese Americans. And so while we can see large communities of Japanese and Chinese Americans, you know, in the 1800s, especially in California, we, you know, don't really see Koreans en masse until the mid-1900s and especially starting in 1970. So I think part of it is that they don't have that same kind of established history that I think allows them to be in all kinds of American institutions or penetrate the mainstream maybe in a similar way. And I think one response among the Korean American community to that is to really rely on one another for helping establish small business entrepreneurship. There's also the Korean American church, which is very ethnically insular. And the church is not just a place where, you know, they go and worship God, but it's a place where they make all kinds of contacts for business, for friendship, for social networking. So I think that, you know, the fact that they haven't had as long of a history, the fact that they're more recent, I think prompts this kind of ethnic networking, ethnic insularity, in part because it's what really allows them to get settled into the United States and hopefully move up.
But you do say that Korean churches actually played an impressive role in building coalitions with Black Americans. I was wondering, did this also happen around the same-sex marriage issue?
You know, I actually know less about that, but my guess is that, you know, among the traditional Korean American church community, they definitely did support Prop 8, the same-sex marriage issue. I'm not sure how much alliance building there was with Black Americans on that, but, you know, to the extent that Black and Korean churches have worked together, it's mostly been around issues of race and ethnicity.
Can you give an example?
Well, like the Los Angeles riots in 1992, I like to call it the unrest, actually. After the unrest in 92, definitely Korean American, Black American churches, through mostly the work of nonprofit advocates, you know, community activists, people like that, they try to join forces to, you know, mend the relationship and also try to get beyond the very sensationalistic media coverage of the unrest that honed in on the Black Korean conflict or the so-called, you know, tensions between the two groups, rather than focusing on the beating of Rodney King and the acquittal of the police officers by the American justice system. So I think at that point, what they did was they had a lot of cultural exchanges where, you know, Korean churches would say, we're going to donate clothing or we're going to raise money for scholarships for underprivileged Black American kids in Los Angeles. We are going to organize trips to South Korea where we take African-American pastors and, you know, other church members to understand what South Korea is like, what South Korea you know, has been through historically, what its relationship is to the United States. And so they have had a lot of these cultural exchanges that I think have fostered political alliances, or at least open the door for political alliances so that they don't have another unrest again.
But in 1992, I remember a lot of the Korean media did call the unrest in LA as the Black riots. And do you think that the lessons learned from that kind of nomenclature and also figuring out where Latinos fit into all of this and Korea, has actually changed how Koreans have been looking at race in the last 10 years or so?
Oh, most definitely, yeah. I think the term Black riots was really popularized in South Korea, in part because I think, you know, obviously they're less connected to it than we are in the United States. And then, you know, based on the media coverage and sort of this sensationalistic kind of view of Black Korean tensions kind of being at the root of the burning for those several days, you know, I think Koreans recognize that they were being used as scapegoats in this conflict because they really felt like this was fundamentally a white-Black conflict that's rooted in that history. And they said, look, this happened because Rodney King was brutally beaten by four white American police officers. And, you know, this was fundamentally about that. And how is it that all of a sudden that Koreans got thrown into this mix, you know, whereby Koreans are largely responsible for the burning of their stores, looting, the chaos and dismay? And I think what they realized was, look, you know, when it comes to allocating blame for the riots or for the race relations struggles, white America is not really willing to look at itself and create criticize itself for them. And I think the other thing that really woke them up was the fact that, you know, Koreatown was burning for days, and the LAPD and the federal government really did not intervene, did not stop the fires and the looting until areas like Westwood and Beverly Hills were affected. And that's when, of course, the federal government decided to bring in the National Guard. And Koreans were really left to fend for themselves for those 4 days. And hence, we saw some of those shots of Koreans, you know, with guns on top of rooftops and things like that. But they recognized that, you know, we are definitely an invisible and foreign minority in the United States, even in a place like L.A.
Thank you. Nadia Kim is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Loyola Marymount University and the author of Imperial Citizens, Koreans and Race from Seoul to L.A.